Recon leader, buried his face in the dirt and started praying. Black and the remaining ST Alabama returned fire. The Green Beret stood there, firing on single shot, picking off NVA, North Vietnamese Army, soldiers on top of the rise. Both the NVA and ST Alabama tended to their wounded, while the living combatants slammed loaded magazines into their hot weapons. Enemy troops quickly reinforced the ambush site. It was always thus. As Meyer documents, through his own experiences, as well as through interviews he conducted for years afterward to recreate the combat sequences, whenever SOG units crossed the border into Cambodia and Laos, they uncovered a beehive of North Vietnamese Army concentrations. The border truly meant nothing. The battlefield overlapped it. Meyer spends 18 pages describing a savage day-long firefight in Laos that ends with many dead, as well as beer in the canteen for the survivors near midnight, before another insertion that meets another enemy troop concentration the next morning. From beginning to end, across the fence is a record of extreme heroism and technical competence that few who fought World War II surpassed. Every time Meyer crossed the border, it was with South Vietnamese Indigs, indigenous troops, integrated into his unit. He writes about their exploits and personalities in as much detail as he does about the Americans. He identifies with them, and with the enemy whose skill he admires, more than he does with elements of the home front. Thanksgiving is just another day across the fence, this time in Cambodia, once again surrounded by North Vietnamese troops, once again saved by the Air Force and the five-second fuses on the Claymore mines. The gods of recon had smiled on ST, Spike Team, Idaho, one more time, he concludes near midnight of that fourth Thursday in November 1968. There is little sense here that the war was lost. While historians cite 1968 as a turning point, because of the home front's reaction to the Tet Offensive, the My Lai Massacre, and the protests at the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, on the ground in Vietnam, 1968 marked a different trend. William Westmoreland was replaced by Creighton Abrams. Population security, rather than enemy body counts, became the measure of merit. Clear and hold territory replaced the dictum of search and destroy, and building up the South Vietnamese Army became the top priority. There came a time when the war was won, even if the fighting wasn't over, writes Lewis Sorley, a West Point graduate and career Army officer, in A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam, 1999. By the end of 1972, Sorley goes on, one could travel almost anywhere in South Vietnam in relative security, even as American ground forces were almost gone. Retirees I know in the armed forces affirm how much more benign an environment South Vietnam was during this period than the Iraq of today. Still, as one veteran told me, everyone has different memories of Vietnam, depending upon where they served and what time they were there. Sorley's book was reviewed prominently by the major liberal newspapers and foreign policy journals. They gave it generally respectful write-ups, a sign of a reassessment of Vietnam based less on ideology than on paying more attention to the second half of a war, a period to which, as Sorley notes, Stanley Carnot's Vietnam, A History, 1983, devotes only 103 out of 670 pages, and Neil Sheehan's Pulitzer Prize-winning A Bright Shining Lie, 1988, devotes 65 out of 790 pages. Sorley told me he isn't sure what would have happened had Congress not cut off aid to South Vietnam at about the same time the ground situation was at its most hopeful. He felt that a respectable case might be made that it would have survived. His book has seen a rise in sales among military officers eager to know how the ground situation in Iraq might be improved to the level it had been in Vietnam, thanks to General Abrams's change of strategy. A similar thesis emerges in The Battle of An Lock, 2005, by retired Army Lieutenant Colonel James H. Wilbanks, who describes a 60-day siege in mid-1972 in which heavily outnumbered South Vietnamese troops and their American advisors, including himself, rebuffed several North Vietnamese divisions. This gave Nixon the fig leaf he needed for a final withdrawal. Optimism then might not have been warranted, but it wasn't altogether blind. Lieutenant Colonel Wilbanks said he wrote his book, published by Indiana University Press, for the same reason Sorley did, to give more attention to the second half of the war. Another book that those in the combat arms community pressed me to read is Once a Warrior King, Memories of an Officer in Vietnam, 1985, by David Donovan, a pseudonym. This is the story of a young Army civil affairs officer in a remote part of South Vietnam near Cambodia, which, as he too documents, was used as a major staging post for the North Vietnamese Army. Herein is a series of feverish accounts of horrific firefights that alternate with the struggle to establish schools, maternity clinics, and agricultural projects. It is as though the author were writing about today's Iraq, a corruption and faction-plagued central government that exists officially but has little reality outside of the capital, a regular U.S. Army that he despises, confined too often to big bases and which the locals hate, and small units like his with life-and-death control over civilians. Terribly frustrated, he realizes that his own countrymen would never understand about all the small but very important things that were needed. Take soap. Just plain old bars of soap, he informs us, would do more to win over the villagers in his district than guns and bullets. He ends his Vietnam saga thus: I do not believe it was an immoral war at all, rather a decent cause gone terribly wrong. You cannot approach Vietnam and Iraq, or the subject of counterinsurgency in general, without reference to Jean Lartigue, a French novelist and war correspondent who, in a very different way than Stockdale, is an example in his own person of the civilian-military divide. Lartigue inhabits the very soul of the modern Western warrior, alienating some civilian readers in the process. Stockdale quotes him. Sorley told me that several editions of Lartigue's The Centurions, 1960, have passed through his hands in the course of a professional lifetime dominated by Vietnam. Alistair Horn, the renowned historian of the Algerian War, uses Lartigue for epigrams in A Savage War of Peace, 1977. Some months back, General David Petraeus, now commander of U.S. ground forces in Iraq, pulled The Centurions off a shelf at his home in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and gave me a disquisition about the small unit leadership principles exemplified by one of the characters. For half a decade now, Green Berets have been recommending Lartigue's The Centurions and The Praetorians, 1961, to me, books about French paratroopers in Vietnam and Algeria in the 1950s. Almost half a century ago, this Frenchman was obsessed about a home front that had no context for a hot, irregular war, about a professional warrior class alienated from its civilian compatriots as much as from its own conventional infantry battalions, about the need to engage in both combat and civil affairs in a new form of warfare to follow an age of what he called victory parades and cinema heroics, about an enemy with complete freedom of action, allowed to do what we didn't dare, and about the danger of creating a sect of singularly brave iron men whose ideals were so exalted that, beyond the battlefield, they had a tendency to become woolly-headed. Lartigue dedicates his book to the memory of centurions who died so that Rome might survive, but he notes in his conclusion that it was these same centurions who destroyed Rome. Born in 1920, Jean Lartigue, a pseudonym, his real name was Jean Hostie, fought with the Free French and afterward became a journalist. Because of his military experience and resistance ties, he had nearly unrivaled access to French paratroopers who fought at Dien Bien Phu and in the Battle of Algiers. His empathy for these men, some of whom were torturers, made him especially loathed by the Parisian left, even though he broke with the paratroopers themselves out of opposition to their political goals, which he labeled neo-fascism. Lartigy eventually found his military ideal in Israel, where he became revered by paratroopers who translated the centurions into Hebrew to read at their training centers. He called these Jewish soldiers the most remarkable of all of war's servants, superior even to the Viet, who at the same time detests war the most. By the mid-1970s, though, he became disillusioned with the Israel Defense Forces. He said it had ceased to be a manageable grouping of commandos and was becoming a cumbersome machine too dependent on American-style technology, as if foreseeing some of the problems with the 2006 Lebanon campaign. Recently, I walked into the office of the Chief of Staff of Army Special Forces in South Korea, Colonel David Maxwell of Springfield, Massachusetts, and noticed a plaque with Lartigy's famous Two Armies quote. The translation is by Jan Fielding, a British Special Operations officer who, in addition to rendering Lartigy's classics into English, was a close friend of the British travel writer Patrick Leigh Fermor, to whom Fermor addresses his introduction in his own classic, A Time of Gifts, 1977. In The Centurions, one of Lartigy's paratroopers declares, "I'd like two armies, one for display, with lovely guns, tanks, little soldiers, fanfares, staffs, distinguished and doddering generals, and dear little regimental officers, an army that would be shown for a modest fee on every fairground in the country. The other would be the real one, composed entirely of young enthusiasts in camouflage battle dress, who would not be put on display, but from whom all sorts of tricks would be taught. That's the army in which I should like to fight." But the reply from another character in The Centurions to this declaration is swift. "You're heading for a lot of trouble." The exchange telescopes the philosophical dilemma about the measures that need to be taken against enemies who would erect a far worse world than you, but which, nevertheless, are impossible to carry out because of the remorse that afflicts soldiers when they violate their own notion of purity of arms, even in situations where such tricks might somehow be rationalized. They win the battle, but lose their souls. Rather than a roughneck, Colonel Maxwell epitomizes the soft, indirect approach to unconventional war that is in contrast to direct action. The message that Maxwell and other warriors have always taken away from Lartigy's famous quote, rooted in his Vietnam experience, is that the mission is everything, and conventional militaries, by virtue of being vast bureaucratic machines obsessed with rank and privilege, are insufficiently focused on the mission, regardless of whether it's direct action or humanitarian affairs. One of the complaints of the MISTI forward air controllers was that their own Air Force bureaucracy was a constant hindrance, more interested in procedure than results. The same complaint has occasionally been made against the regular army in Iraq by Marines and Green Berets. The conventional officer would reply that the warrior's field of sight is so narrow that he can't see anything beyond the mission. "They're dangerous," one of Lartigy's protagonists says of the paratroopers, "because they go to any lengths beyond the conventional notion of good and evil." For if the warrior's actions contradict his faith, his doubts are easily overcome by belief in the larger cause. Lartigy writes of one soldier, "He had placed the whole of his life under the sign of Christ, who had preached peace, charity, brotherhood, and at the same time he had arranged for the delayed action bombs at the Cat B airfield. What of it? There's a war on, and we can't allow Hanoi to be captured." Vietnam, like Iraq, represented a war of frustrating half-measures, fought against an enemy that respected no limits. Bud Day, half-starved and broken-limbed, writes of seeing a long convoy of trucks heading out of Hanoi, safe because of our own self-imposed bombing restrictions. "I found it mind-boggling that the United States, the strongest nation in the world, would permit this flea on the buttocks of humanity to conduct a war this way." More than almost any writer I know, Lartigy communicates the intensity of such frustrations, which in turn create the psychological gulf that separates warriors like Bud Day from both a conscript army and a civilian home front. The best units, according to Lartigy, while officially built on high ideals, are in fact products of such deep bonds of brotherhood and familiarity that the world outside requires a dose of cynicism merely to stomach. As one Green Beret wrote me, "There are no more cynical soldiers on the planet than the SF, special forces, guys I work with. They snort at the platitudes we are expected to parrot. But," he went on, "you will not find anyone who gets the job done better in tough environments like Iraq." In fact, in extreme situations like Iraq, cynics may actually serve a purpose. In the regular army, there is a tendency to report up the command chain that the mission is succeeding, even if it isn't. Cynics won't buy that, and will say so bluntly. Lartigy writes that the warrior looks down on the rest of the military as the profession of the sluggard, men who get up early to do nothing. Yet, as one paratrooper notes in the Praetorians, "In Algeria, that type of officer died out. When we came in from operations, we had to deal with the police, build sports grounds, attend classes. Regulations? They hadn't provided for anything, even if one tried to make an exegesis of them with the subtlety of a rabbi." Dirty, badly conceived wars in Vietnam and Algeria had begotten a radicalized French warrior class of non-commissioned officers, able to kill in the morning and build schools in the afternoon, which had a higher regard for its Muslim guerrilla adversaries than for regular officers in its own ranks. Such men would gladly advance toward a machine gun nest without looking back, and yet were booed by the crowds upon returning home, so that they saw the civilian society they were defending as vile, corrupt, and degraded. The estrangement of soldiers from their own citizenry is somewhat particular to counterinsurgencies, where there are no neat battle lines, and thus no easy narrative for the people back home to follow. The frustrations in these wars are great precisely because they are not easily communicated. Lartigy writes, "Imagine an environment where a whole garrison of 2,000 troops are held in check by a small band of thugs and murderers. The enemy is able to know everything, every movement of our troops, the departure times of our convoys. Meanwhile, we're rushing about the bare mountains, exhausting our men. We shall never be able to find anything." Because the enemy is not limited by Western notions of war, the temptation arises among a stymied soldiery to bend its own rules. Following an atrocity carried out by French paratroopers that calms a rural area of Algeria, one soldier rationalizes to another, "Fear has changed sides, tongues have been loosened. We obtained more in a day than in 6 months fighting, and more with 27 dead than with several hundreds." The soldiers comfort themselves further with a quotation from a 14th century Catholic bishop, "When her existence is threatened, the church is absolved of all moral commandments." It is the purest of them, according to Lartigy, who is most likely to commit torture. Here we enter territory that is utterly unrelated to the individual Americans I've been writing about. It is important to make such distinctions. When Lartigy writes about bravery and alienation, he understands American warriors. When he writes about political insurrections and torture, some exceptions aside, he is talking about a particular caste of French paratroopers. Yet, his discussion is relevant to America's past in Vietnam and present in Iraq. I don't mean My Lai and Abu Ghraib, both of which aided the enemy rather than ourselves, but the moral gray area that we increasingly inhabit concerning collateral civilian deaths. In The Face of War, Reflections of Men and Combat, 1976, Lartigy writes that contemporary wars are, in particular, made for the side that doesn't care about the preservation of a good conscience. So he asks, How do you explain that to save liberty, liberty must first be suppressed? His answer can only be thus. In that rests the weakness of democratic regimes, a weakness that is, at the same time, a credit to them, an honor. What kind of soldier can make the most of such limitations? Lartigy found his answer in the elite Israeli units of the mid-20th century, which were in turn a product of Lartigy's own personal hero, Ord Wingate. Wingate is of paramount importance because of the way he confronted challenges similar to those faced by America in Vietnam and again in Iraq. Lartigy writes, "The Israeli army was born of that mad old genius Ord Wingate and his midnight battalions of Jewish warriors, which included the young Moshe Dayan and Yigal Alon. The Israelis would say of this goy, if he hadn't died, he would be head of our army." Wingate was a Christian evangelical before the term was coined. The son of a minister in colonial India, he frequently quoted scripture and read Hebrew. In 1936, Captain Wingate was dispatched to Palestine from Sudan. For religious reasons, he developed an emotional sympathy for the Israelis, establishing himself as the Lawrence of the Jews. He taught them to fight in the dark with knives and grenades, to specialize in ambushes and hand-to-hand fighting. Wingate headed to Ethiopia in 1941, leading Ethiopian irregulars in the struggle to defeat the Italians and put the Negus Nagast, King of Kings Haile Selassie, back on the throne. From there, it was on to Burma, where he consolidated his principles of irregular warfare with his famed Chindits, long-penetration jungle warriors, dropped by parachute behind Japanese lines. He took the name from the legendary animal, half eagle and half lion, whose statue graces Indo-Chinese pagodas. According to Lartigy, Wingate was openly obsessed with a dislike of conventional armies that used parades to transform its young men into automatons. Instead, Wingate thought in terms of individuals, and believed that if he had the right young men, he could do more with 10 of them than with 100 of the conventional kind. Wingate would teach these select few trickery, that is, how to be assassins, how to ambush, how to get accustomed to broken sleep rhythms and brackish water for drinking, how to win over the local tribes. Lartigy's famed Two Armies quote, with its reference to tricks, was partly based on Wingate's vision, forged initially in Sudan and Palestine, and refined in the Horn of Africa and Indochina. It was in Vietnam where Lartigy first encountered the historical figure of Wingate, whose warrior ethos would ultimately merge with that of the Green Berets in the early part of the Vietnam War. Uri Dan, a longtime Israeli journalist, a devotee of Lartigy, and an intimate of Ariel Sharon, told me that democracies of today, because of the existential threat they face from an enemy that knows no limits, need centurions more than ever. He's right, but only up to a point. Take this story told to me by a Navy lieutenant at Annapolis who had commanded a SEAL team in Iraq. Time after time, the lieutenant's combined American-Iraqi team would capture bad guys with long rap sheets who were undoubtedly terrorists. His unit would hand them over to higher authorities, but after a few weeks in prison, they would be released and go back to killing civilians. The Iraqis and my own men saw how broken the system was, and some felt it was easier just to kill these guys the moment we apprehended them. After all, it would have saved lives. But, he continued, I told them, oh no, here is where I have to draw the line. It was important to have an officer in charge who had studied ethics. The enlisted chief petty officers of his SEAL team, reminiscent of some of Lartigy's centurions for all intents and purposes, were the finest men he had ever commanded, but they required supervision. A frustrated warrior class, always kept in check by liberal-minded officers, is the sign of a healthy democracy. 7. Iraq, The Counterfactual Game. The Atlantic, October 2008. As an early supporter of the war in Iraq, I, like others, have taken refuge in counterfactuals. All the bad things that might have happened had we left Saddam Hussein in power. Counterfactuals, if you haven't noticed, have become a staple of conservative opinion pages. Indeed, the list of what-ifs is long and compelling. Just some examples. Had we not invaded, the sanctions regime against the Iraqi dictator would soon have crumbled without the oil-for-food scandal being exposed. The French, Russians, and Chinese would have swept in with lucrative deals for Saddam, even as he restarted his weapons program. The arms race between Iraq and Iran would have grown fierce, with many, especially the Iranians, believing Saddam already possessed weapons of mass destruction. Israel would have been the big loser in this arms race, feeling less secure and consequently more trigger-happy than ever. Saddam's grip on power would have surged with the price of oil. Drowning in oil wealth, Saddam would have, among many other nefarious deeds, increased his payments to the families of Palestinian suicide bombers. In a larger strategic sense, the success of Saddam Hussein, an implacable hater of the West, in forcing President George W. Bush to stand down his troops and beat the sanctions too, would have had a radicalizing effect on the entire Muslim world. He would have emerged as the new Nasser of the Sunni faithful, from Morocco to Pakistan, even as he continued to murder in desultory fashion thousands of people per month in his police state. As a footnote, sooner or later an American Navy or Air Force aviator would have been shot down patrolling the no-fly zones and paraded through the streets of Baghdad, thus providing immense propaganda value. Truly, a world with Saddam still in power is awful to contemplate, as I can personally attest, having visited Iraq several times in the 1980s, the worst years of Saddam's tyranny. Yet, there is a problem with this line of reasoning. How do all these might-have-beens, as frightfully convincing as they seem, stack up against the very real, violent deaths of more than 4,000 Americans and tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Iraqis as a result of our invasion, not to mention the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the war that could have been used to meet other threats to our national interests? To coldly state, without qualifiers, that these costs have been a price worth paying is to reduce foreign policy to the realm of inhuman abstraction. In any case, I don't believe anyone making such a claim could pass a polygraph test. And I include President Bush in this category. His attempts to compare himself with President Harry Truman, a president whose decisions were also hated at the time he made them, have the air of desperation rather than of historical thinking. I am aware that the American death toll in Iraq is many times lower than that in Vietnam, and that aversion to casualties has become a feature of low birth rate post-industrial democratic societies. But I am also aware that when I and others supported a war to liberate Iraq, we never fully or accurately contemplated the price that would have to be paid. Of course, it can be argued that the high human cost of the war was not a result of the invasion at all, but of the negligence that characterized the subsequent military occupation. But you could well make the case that such negligence was at least partially inherent in the hubris of the conception of regime change in the first place. Moreover, when you sign on to a war, you implicitly place your confidence in those who would carry it out. Thus, a character judgment is required, and events have shown how wrong supporters of the war were in this regard. At a far deeper level, as with many of life's disappointments, you are stuck with the reality that you have, not the one that might have been. You can play the counterfactual game for all of history's great junctures, and as enlightening as the exercise can be, it is still a game that doesn't get you anywhere. It is where we are now that matters, overextended in Iraq and Afghanistan, while the Russians move methodically to recreate their former Soviet near abroad in the Caucasus and Central Asia, and the Chinese continue to use the years of our Middle East distraction to become, in military parlance, a future peer competitor. We are undeniably in a far better situation in Iraq today than we were in 2006. Credit for that must go to President Bush. He bravely, and wisely as it turned out, ignored the advice of almost the entire Washington establishment, surged troops into the country, changed his strategy, his generals, and his defense secretary. In this very limited sense, he might yet be compared with Truman. Iraq could well stumble along to greater democratic stability, leading not to a model state, but to a viable and non-threatening one, which can, in the fullness of time, encourage liberal movements throughout the Arab world. Might one then argue that the invasion was worth it? From a purely historical perspective, perhaps. But policy is about the here and now. It's about taking or not taking action based on a near and middle-term cost-benefit analysis. To subsume policymaking completely to long-range historical thinking is to risk constantly getting involved in grand schemes. Most fundamentally, does Iraq meet the parents' test? Can you look parents in the eye and tell them it was worth losing their son or daughter over? As awful as it sounds, quantity matters here, for it says much about the scope of violence that is unleashed for the sake of a higher good. If there were, say, 500 sets of parents you had to look in the eye, the answer might well be yes, it was worth it, given where Iraq is today, and what might have been had we not toppled Saddam. But at more than 4,000 and counting, the answer, for years to come, will still be no. Counterfactuals can take you only so far. 8. The Wounded Homefront. The American Interest, January-February 2011. Covering the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, I learned that most of the landmines that the Soviets laid were designed to maim, not kill. The Soviets knew that a dead body causes no tactical inconvenience. It only removes the one dead person from the field. But a wounded person requires the assistance of people all the way down the line who could otherwise be fighting. Likewise, with the home front in a war. The dead leave an awful vacancy in the lives of loved ones, but those who are seriously wounded or psychologically traumatized can disrupt families and society more. Families of the dead can move on, as difficult as it may be, and as awful as it may be to say. The families of the seriously maimed, physically or psychologically, never can. Army Colonel Ross Brown, a squadron commander in Iraq, told me this story. After a suicide bomber killed four of my soldiers, my command sergeant major, CSM, and I spent a night picking up their body parts. I walked around one side of the blast area while my CSM covered the other side. An 18-year-old soldier walked behind me, towing a body bag. As I came upon a limb or other body part, I would place it in the bag and move on to the next body part. After 6 hours of walking the blast radius, I had a full bag. Although I knew the soldier beside me was young, and even as I tried to protect the youngest soldiers from seeing such terrible things, I had to use him to assist me that evening. The next day, I had him see a psychologist, and had him see one again after we returned from Iraq. However, less than a year later, I signed paperwork releasing him from the Army for post-traumatic stress disorder and long-term psychological damage. To be sure, the dead and the psychologically wounded of that terrible evening will have ripple effects upon their families and the larger society for years to come. And this is merely one story. Nancy Berglass, director of the Iraq-Afghanistan Deployment Impact Fund, says, "Hundreds of thousands of active duty and former active duty troops are dealing with significant mental health and drug dependence problems that have not been adequately addressed. In each instance of psychological disturbance, there is a story, perhaps as bad as Colonel Brown's, behind it." The long tale of suffering that extends from the war front to the home front, and from dead and wounded soldiers and marines, sailors and airmen, to their wives and children, and to their children's children, is statistically numbing and heartrending. Of the 2.2 million American troops deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001, several hundred thousand have sustained physical and psychological wounds. The figures of 4,417 dead from Iraq and 1,368 from Afghanistan, as of November 10, 2010, are well known and oft quoted. But the physically wounded from both wars number more than 40,000, a staggering number, and roughly three-quarters of them have been wounded in a serious life- and family-affecting way. According to the Army Office of the Surgeon General, between 2001 and 2009, doctors performed 1,286 amputations, three-quarters of which were of major limbs. Then there are the psychological wounds, to which Colonel Brown's story attests. Between 20% and 35% of deployed troops test positive for depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. More than 100,000 soldiers today are on prescribed anti-anxiety medication, and 40,000 are thought by the Army to be using drugs illicitly. At least one in six service members is on some form of psychiatric drug. The effect on wives and children is immense. There have been around 25,000 cases of domestic violence in military families in the past decade. 20% of married troops returning from deployment are planning a divorce. Problems in family relationships are reportedly four times higher following a deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan. In families where one of the spouses is deployed, instances of child abuse are 40% higher than the norm. In 2009 alone, 74,646 criminal offenses were committed by soldiers. In 2009 alone, there were 334 military suicides. Marine Corps suicides are now 24 per 100,000, compared to 20 in the civilian population. 18 veterans a day die by their own hand. As for active duty troops, Berglass says they are taking their own lives at the rate of one every 36 hours. These may not seem like such high numbers, but keep in mind that in the 1990s, the Army and other armed services were touted as the most disciplined and psychologically healthiest sector of the population. Then there is homelessness. Homelessness is only partly a sign of insufficient financial means. At a deeper level, it can be about the inability to cope with the complexities of modern life following a period of sustained trauma. Veterans for America estimates that 10,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are now homeless. During the Vietnam War, the number of homeless veterans exceeded the number of fatalities, 58,000, and experts have told me that veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are becoming homeless at a quicker rate than those of Vietnam. One-third of the adult homeless population are veterans, even as veterans represent only 11% of the population. Furthermore, young male veterans of the Iraq War had an unemployment rate of 21.6% in 2009, more than double that of the general population. Foreclosure rates in military towns are running at four times the national average. Then there are the rates of underwater mortgages, in which the family owes more on the loan than the value of the house. There are no adequate statistics for this regarding the military, but experts assume the rate is much higher than for the civilian population because war means deployments, and deployments mean moving locations at a quicker rate than in a peacetime army. That, in turn, leads to more disadvantageous house purchases. I have heard stories of returning wounded veterans with amputated limbs who have trouble finding jobs and whose mortgages are in foreclosure or underwater. Though these stories may seem apocryphal, they make unmistakable sense given the other statistics. Retired Army Major General Robert Scales indicates that such statistics are central to what land warfare does to a ground force. too few troops have been carrying too heavy a burden for too long, he told government executive reporter Catherine McIntyre Peters. There was a debate back in the dark days of 2006, when America's land forces were suffering their highest numbers of casualties, about whether Iraq would break the army. Such numbers indicate that it has already done so, at least partially. Edith Wharton, in a somewhat obscure anti-war classic, A Son at the Front, 1923, writes of war's jaded appetite, of the monster's daily meal, devouring all the gifts and virtues, brains in the bud, imagination and poetry of so many young men. But at least Wharton is writing about World War I in France, where there is an authentic home front to which the wounded and traumatized can return, where all of society is swept into the great effort, compared to which all else is trivial. So the hotels and households of the rich are shrunken and understaffed. Hallways in Paris are piled with hospital supplies. Every family has someone at the front. War is the subject of nearly every conversation. Indeed, the cruelest fate for the seriously wounded and those psychologically oppressed by awful memories is to return to a civilian society with distinctly other matters on its mind. For unlike the war Wharton wrote about, we in America famously constitute an army at war and a nation at the mall. This is not necessarily a function of our prosperity, given that in relative terms the economy is stagnant and many people are out of work, nor is it a matter of hostility toward the military. The post-9/11 Middle Eastern wars have not bred aversion to the soldier's profession as did Vietnam. It is a matter of the particular wages of what are termed small wars, that is, hot, irregular wars that are big enough to be intensely fought and are seemingly endless, but are limited in that they do not demand a state's total resources, and therefore leave the home front unscathed and unaffected, without context for the horror occurring thousands of miles away. Big wars are fought in response to a direct threat to the homeland, and by definition involve the whole society. They are wars that play to the strengths of a mass democracy. But small wars are imperial wars, even as proponents of small wars eschew the term. They are fought to preserve the balance of power and to stamp out disorder in far-flung places, motives beyond the grasp of the home front. Small wars, because they are often unconventional, lack a well-defined narrative. There is no army to follow as it marches toward its objective. Thus, the home front finds these wars confusing, that is to say, meaningless. The wounded and other uniformed warriors who come home to such a confused and distracted society suffer a very special kind of loneliness and alienation. They might also fall prey to a dose of cynicism, according to the French war reporter and novelist of the mid-20th century Jean Lartigue, who wrote of paratroopers in Vietnam and Algeria, unable to adapt to the mores of civilian society after having gone through an intense and lengthy bonding experience defined by constant combat in irregular, small wars. Because of modern communication, today's fighting men and women are arguably under greater degrees of stress regarding family issues than ever before, even as they find it difficult to talk to their families once they are back home about what is really on their minds. In the barracks every night in Iraq or Afghanistan, there is a constant stream of communication with spouses and children via email and various websites. But these troops are psychologically cut off from loved ones, even as they are electronically connected to them. I can remember several instances when, as an embedded reporter, I was in a morale, welfare, and recreation facility in the Middle East, overhearing American troops having heated arguments with their wives or girlfriends over a phone line, while other soldiers lined up impatiently behind them, waiting to use the same phone. Indeed, domestic disputes take on an especially intense urgency precisely because the means of contact is virtual, and yet in no way does this prepare individual soldiers for what they will encounter when they do arrive home, particularly if they are wounded or come to suffer a variant of post-traumatic stress syndrome. The returning soldier, too, is burdened by the particular experience of small, irregular wars. Colonel Brown explains that when soldiers are killed by improvised explosive devices, IEDs, catastrophic explosion rips them apart. Those soldiers who survive will see and hear explosions in their minds continually, which only amplifies their fear. This fear is cumulative and debilitating over the course of a deployment. In a conventional war, you most fear being in the front lines. In an unconventional one, you can be killed almost anywhere, at any time, so there is no time or place for fear to dissipate. Furthermore, in an unconventional war, in which a soldier sees his comrades killed and lose limbs in explosions, there is no tangible measure of accomplishment as there is in a conventional war, where large swaths of territory are rolled up. This adds to the soldier's demoralization. And as soldiers deploy and redeploy to war zones, they and their families suffer the knowledge of what the last deployment did to them, knowing that they now have to relive it. And as the years go on, with no end in sight to at least one of these wars, Brown notes that military communities at bases in the United States become more insular, more psychologically cut off from the rest of the home front. In A Son at the Front, Wharton countenances the efficacy of war in providing for historical progress. The liberties of England had been born of the ruthless discipline of the Norman conquest, and more freedom and a wiser order had been born of the hideous welter of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. It is thus tempting to argue, or at least to think, that over the course of the decades, the invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan will bear fruit. After all, even a weak democracy in Iraq will be the first of its kind in a major Arab country. In addition, Iraq might become a de facto ally of the United States, with a civil society engrossed in domestic problems rather than confrontations with Israel. Moreover, the consequences of leaving Saddam Hussein in power to restart his weapons program and become the new anti-Western Nasser of the Arab world were dreadful. Afghanistan, too, could yet evolve as a new Silk Road nexus of Central Asia. But even if the United States gains strategically from these two invasions, this is mere abstract historical thinking. Policy is about the here and now. It is about taking or not taking action based on a near and middle-term cost-benefit analysis. To subsume policy-making completely to long-range historical projections is to risk constantly getting involved in grand schemes and to ignore the concrete effects that such policies have on real people, both Americans and others. Thus, in the face of this human devastation, there is little absolution for those like myself who supported the Iraq War. Of course, the results of the Iraq War were born as much from the disastrous way in which the war and post-war phase were carried out as from the decision to invade itself. That could well be true of the war in Afghanistan as well. Still, to talk of complete absolution given these statistics is too convenient. And yet, there is a danger of taking this line of argument too far, for to focus solely on the hell to which so many families have been subjected is to blind oneself to the very real great power responsibilities the United States has. For example, if U.S. military intervention in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s had resulted in, say, 500 American dead and 5,000 seriously wounded, physically and psychologically, rather than virtually none, as was the case, would those deployments still have been worth it? I think so, because they stopped an ethnic killing machine. But where do we draw the line? When does this many or that many dead or this many wounded or that many traumatized add up to failure? The question has no good answer, but it is important that we always ask it. For years covering the military, I was told by Marines and Army Special Forces troops that they did not want anybody's pity, and that media fixation with the dead and wounded has the effect of turning all soldiers into victims. They prefer to think of themselves as warriors. That's a fine attitude for them to have, but for the home front to think similarly would dehumanize it. The home front gropes for a way to connect with the wounded and their families. The fact that this is much harder to do than we suppose it ought to be is a particular wage of small wars, wars that we should do all in our power to henceforth avoid. 9. No Greater Honor. The Atlantic, June 2008. Over the decades, the Medal of Honor, the highest award for valor, has evolved into the U.S. military equivalent of sainthood. Only 8 Medals of Honor have been awarded since the Vietnam War, all posthumously. "You don't have to die to win it, but it helps," says Army Colonel Thomas P. Smith. A West Point graduate from the Bronx, Smith has a unique perspective. He was a battalion commander in Iraq when one of his men performed actions that resulted in the Medal of Honor. It was then-Lieutenant Colonel Smith who pushed the paperwork for the award through the Pentagon bureaucracy, a 2-year process. On the morning of April 4, 2003, the 11th Engineer Battalion of the 3rd Infantry Division broke through to Baghdad International Airport. With sporadic fighting all around, Smith's men began to blow up captured ordnance that was blocking the runways. Nobody had slept, showered, or eaten much for weeks. In the midst of this mayhem, Smith got word that one of his platoon leaders, Sergeant First Class Paul Ray Smith, no relation, of Tampa, Florida, had been killed an hour earlier in a nearby firefight. Before he could react emotionally to the news, he was given another piece of information. The 33-year-old sergeant had been hit while firing a 50-caliber heavy machine gun mounted on an armored personnel carrier. That was highly unusual, since it wasn't Sergeant Smith's job to fire the 50 cal. "That and other stray neurons of odd information about the incident started coming at me," explains Colonel Smith. But there was no time then to follow up, for within hours they were off in support of another battalion that was about to be overrun. And a few days after that, other members of the platoon, who had witnessed Sergeant Smith's last moments, were themselves killed. Within a week, the environment had changed, though. Baghdad had been secured, and the battalion enjoyed a respite that was crucial to the legacy of Sergeant First Class Paul Smith. Lieutenant Colonel Smith used the break to have one of his lieutenants get statements from everyone who was with Sergeant Smith at the time of his death. An astonishing story emerged. Sergeant First Class Paul Ray Smith was the ultimate iron grunt, the kind of relentless, professional, non-commissioned officer that the all-volunteer, expeditionary American military has been quietly producing for 4 decades. "The American people provide broad brand management approval of the U.S. military," notes Colonel Smith, "about how great it is and how much they support it, but the public truly has no idea how skilled and experienced many of these troops are." Sergeant Smith had fought and served in Desert Storm, Bosnia, and Kosovo prior to Operation Iraqi Freedom. To his men, he was an intense, infuriating, by-the-book taskmaster, in the words of Alex Leary of the St. Petersburg Times, Sergeant Smith's hometown newspaper. Long after other platoons were let off duty, Sergeant Smith would be drilling his men late into the night, checking the cleanliness of their rifle barrels with the Q-tips he carried in his pocket. During one inspection, he found a small screw missing from a soldier's helmet. He called the platoon back to drill until 10 p.m. "He wasn't an in-your-face type," Colonel Smith told me, "just a methodical, hard-ass professional who had been in combat in Desert Storm and took it as his personal responsibility to prepare his men for it." Sergeant Smith's mindset epitomized the Western philosophy on war. War is not a way of life, an interminable series of hit-and-run raids for the sake of vendetta and tribal honor in societies built on blood and discord. War is awful, to be waged only as a last resort and with terrific intensity to elicit a desired outcome in the shortest possible time. Because Sergeant Smith took war seriously, He never let up on his men, and never forgot about them. In a letter to his parents before deploying to Iraq, he wrote, "There are two ways to come home, stepping off the plane and being carried off the plane. It doesn't matter how I come home, because I am prepared to give all that I am to ensure that all my boys make it home." On what would turn out to be the last night of his life, Sergeant Smith elected to go without sleep. He let others rest inside the slow-moving vehicles that he was ground-guiding on foot through dark thickets of palm trees en route to the Baghdad airport. The next morning, that unfailing regard for the soldiers under his command came together with his consummate skill as a warrior, not in a single impulsive act like jumping on a grenade, as incredibly brave as that is, but in a series of deliberate and ultimately fatal decisions. Sergeant Smith was directing his platoon to lay concertina wire across the corner of a courtyard near the airport in order to create a temporary holding area for Iraqi prisoners of war. Then he noticed Iraqi troops massing, armed with AK-47s, RPGs, and mortars. Soon, mortar fire had wounded three of his men, the crew of the platoon's M113A3 armored personnel carrier. 100 well-armed Iraqis were now firing on his 16-man platoon. Sergeant Smith threw grenades and fired an AT-4, a bazooka-like anti-tank weapon. A Bradley fighting vehicle from another unit managed to hold off the Iraqis for a few minutes, but then inexplicably left, out of ammunition, it would later turn out. Sergeant Smith was now in his rights to withdraw his men from the courtyard, but he rejected that option because it would have threatened American soldiers who were manning a nearby roadblock and an aid station. Instead, he decided to climb atop the Vietnam-era armored personnel carrier whose crew had been wounded and man the 50-caliber machine gun himself. He asked Private Michael Seaman to go inside the vehicle and to feed him a box of ammunition whenever the private heard the gun go silent. Seaman, under Sergeant Smith's direction, moved the armored personnel carrier back a few feet to widen Smith's field of fire. Sergeant Smith was now completely exposed from the waist up, facing 100 Iraqis firing at him from three directions, including from inside a well-protected sentry post. He methodically raked them, from right to left and back. Three times his gun went silent, and three times the private reloaded him, while Sergeant Smith sat exposed to withering fire. He succeeded in breaking the Iraqi attack, killing perhaps dozens of the enemy while going through 400 rounds of ammunition before being shot in the head. What impressed Colonel Smith about the incident was that, no matter how many platoon members he solicited for statements, the story's details never varied. Even when embedded journalists like Alex Leary and Michael Corkery of the Providence Journal Bulletin investigated the incident, they came away with the same narrative. After talking with another battalion commander and his brigade commander, Colonel Smith decided to recommend his sergeant for the Medal of Honor. He was now operating in unfamiliar territory. Standards for the Medal of Honor are vague, if not undefinable. Whereas the Medal of Honor, according to the regulations, is for gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his or her life above and beyond the call of duty, the Distinguished Service Cross, the next highest decoration, is for an act or acts of heroism so notable and involving risk of life so extraordinary as to set the individual apart from his comrades. There is no metric to differentiate between the two awards, or, for that matter, to set the Distinguished Service Cross apart from the Silver Star. It is largely a matter of a commanding officer's judgment. Colonel Smith prepared the paperwork while surrounded by photos of Saddam Hussein in one of the Iraqi leader's palaces. The process began with Army Form DA-638, the same form used to recommend someone for an Army Achievement Medal, the lowest peacetime award. The only difference was Colonel Smith's note to see attached. There are 9 bureaucratic levels of processing for the Medal of Honor. Smith's paperwork didn't even make it past the first. Word came down from the headquarters of the 3rd Infantry Division that he needed a lot more documentation. Smith prepared